It's been an awesome service so far, right from the opening prayer, where we heard some numbers of Canadians who've been involved in wars on behalf of Canada for the last many years, to the theme that was behind each of the hymns that was given today, a theme of Remembrance Day. In the words of encouragement, we also had a theme of remembrance. And for the message today, it's going to be two parts. The first part, the first page is going to cover some information about Remembrance Day in Canada. And the second part of the message is going to talk about some battles that have occurred in the Bible and some lessons that we can learn from those battles. So I've selected seven battles. And if you recall from my last message, there's different types of sermons. This one's going to be more of a narrative type of sermon where when I'm talking about the battles, I'm not necessarily going to read about each one, but I'll paraphrase what happened in each of the battles, and we'll talk about some of the lessons that we can learn from those battles. So to begin, Remembrance Day from the Canadian perspective, it was first observed in 1919 throughout the British Commonwealth. It was originally called Armistice Day to commemorate the armistice agreement that ended the First World War. On Monday, November 11th, 1918, at 11 a.m., on the 11th hour, 11th day of the 11th month. Nowadays, people remember those who were lost in the war by holding a two minutes of silence at 11 o'clock and wearing a red poppy. The first Remembrance Day was observed on November 11th, 1931, so the name was changed to Remembrance Day in Canada in 1931. In the U.S., the name was changed to Veterans Day in 1954. Interestingly, in the States, they actually have 2 days. They have Memorial Day in the spring that starts their summer vacation season. And so Memorial Day is for those that have died in battle, and Remembrance Day is for anyone who's participated in the armed forces. In Canada, we remember more than 2,300,000 Canadians who have served through our nation's history and the more than 118,000 who have made the ultimate sacrifice. In Flanders Field is a war poem written during the First World War by the Canadian physician, Lieutenant Colonel John McCrae. He was inspired to write it on May 3, 1915, after presiding over the funeral of a friend and fellow soldier, Lieutenant Alexis Helmer, who died in the second battle of, and I had to look this word up on Google and have it pronounced. There's three different pronunciations that I looked up, and all three were different. But I believe the battle was called Ypres in western Belgium. And again, in the map that's shown there, it shows a map of Belgium, and Flanders is that region that's in the top left, that's the Flanders region of Belgium, and Ypres is the city that's listed there. So that's where the battle that took place that inspired the lieutenant colonel to write the poem in Flanders Fields. It says, as with his earlier poems in Flanders Fields, continues McCrae's preoccupation with death and how it stands as a transition between the struggle of life on one side and the peace that follows. So you have the struggle of life, you have death that occurs, and then you have the peace that follows. That's a theme in his writing. It says it's written from the point of view of the dead, and it speaks of their sacrifices and serves as their command to the living to press on. As with many of the most popular works of the First World War, it's written early in the conflict, before the romanticism of war had turned to bitterness and disillusion for soldiers and civilians alike. A lot of times when people think about war, they think about these romantic notions of being heroes and the camaraderie and almost fun of being with friends and fighting together and being heroes together. A lot of romantic notions to that. by the end of the war, the romantic notions of war were gone. It's a case that's, the fighting was bitter. In the case of the First World War, a lot of it was trench warfare, where you're in a trench on this side of the field, and they're in a trench on the other side of the field, and if anyone sticks their head up, they get shot at, and the conditions are cold, the food is lousy, and, the romanticism of war being this great fun time is fairly quickly gone. It's a lot of struggle and suffering that the soldiers had to endure. It says, the Second Battle of Ypres was the first mass use by Germany of poison gas on the Western Front. So the Flanders Field was written for someone who died in one of these poison gas attacks. And in fact, it was one of the first poison gas attacks, one of the first times Germany used that kind of gas. It says, German troops carried 5,730 gas cylinders weighing 90 pounds to the front by hand. The cylinders, opened by hand, relied on the prevailing wind to carry the gas towards the enemy lines. Because of this method of dispersal, a large number of German soldiers were injured or killed while carrying out the attack. French troops in the path of the gas cloud sustained about 6,000 casualties. Many died within 10 minutes, primarily from asphyxia and tissue damage in the lungs. Many more were blinded. Chlorine gas forms hypochlorous acid when combined with water, destroying moist tissue in the lungs and eyes. The chlorine gas, denser than air, quickly filled the trenches and forced the troops out into the heavy enemy fire. A horrendous thing, and incredibly surprisingly effective. Canadian troops defended the flank of the break-in by urinating into cloth and holding it to their faces to counter the effects of the gas. It says the German high command had not foreseen the effectiveness of the new weapon. They didn't realize it was going to be this effective, and they didn't necessarily take advantage of all the opportunities they had. Not surprising, the Bible has a lot to say about war as well. There's many battles listed in Scripture. In many ways, through song and through Scripture, we're told that we are to be Christian soldiers. The book of James talks about, where does war come from? And it comes from the lust that's within us. Interestingly, in the travels that I have from Kingston to here, when I'm driving with Jim Leith and with Barb, we get to chatting about different things. And I mentioned that a Remembrance Day message was coming, and the first thing that came to Jim's mind when we were talking was the idea that Israel didn't have to fight all those wars. God said He would fight the battles for them. If they would have had faith in God, that's what would have happened. And so, I thought that was a powerful point, and that was the first point I was going to lead with today. In Exodus 14, verses 13 to 14, it says, Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Eternal, which He will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see no more again forever. The Eternal will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace." In 14 verse 25 it says, "He caused their chariot wheels to swerve, and He made them drive with difficulty. So the Egyptians said, 'Let us flee from Israel, for the Lord is fighting for them against the Egyptians.'" Can you imagine? You're an Egyptian soldier, an expert in army, an expert riding your chariot, and you know that today something's different. Something's forcing the chariot wheels to be swerving in a way that you've never experienced before. And you know that it's the God of Israel that's doing it. And again, the Pharaoh is still driving the Egyptian army to go forward, but they're doing it with terror of God, who's intervening on behalf of Israel. In Exodus says, the Lord, the Eternal, is a warrior. The Eternal is his name. In Deuteronomy it says, the Lord your God who goes before you will himself fight on your behalf, just as he did for you in Egypt before your eyes. In Deuteronomy 3 it says, do not fear them, for the Eternal your God is the one fighting for you. Later on in Joshua, we have the situation where the sun stands still. So there's this battle that happens in the book of Joshua where God is granting a great victory, but the sun is starting to set, and so they can't finish this victory. And so Joshua prays, and the sun stands still so that they can continue the battle. In Joshua 10:14 it says, there was no day like that before or after it, when the Eternal listened to the voice of a man, for the Eternal fought for Israel. So that kind of a miracle is something that only God can perform. Joshua 23 says, and you have all seen that the Eternal your God has done unto all these nations because of you, for the Lord your God is he who has been fighting for you. In 2 Chronicles 20 it says, and the dread of God was on all the kingdoms of the land when they heard that the Eternal had fought against the enemies of Israel. And later on in Nehemiah, at whatever place you hear the sound of a trumpet, rally to us there, for God will fight for us. So the idea that God's going to fight our battles for us isn't just something that's found in one little verse way back there somewhere. It's something that's found in many verses. From the blessings and cursings chapter, that's Deuteronomy 28, where God talks about, if you do these things, I'm going to bless you to smithereens. But if you don't do these things, here's the curses that are going to come upon you. In that blessings and cursings chapter, it starts out in Deuteronomy 28:1, where it says, now it shall come to pass, if you diligently obey the voice of the Eternal your God, to observe carefully all his commandments, which I command you today, then, and here's one of the blessings that God promises. In Deuteronomy 28 verse 7 it says, the Eternal will cause your enemies who rise against you to be defeated before your face. They shall come out against you one way and flee before you seven ways. And again, that's a powerful image. Because when an enemy comes at you one way, that's because they think that they're big and powerful. They're going to come and they're going to run you over. So the enemy comes at you one way, and because God was fighting for Israel, they're fleeing seven ways. They're climbing over the trees and climbing the bushes, and every direction that they can flee, that's what the way they're running. So God promises a mighty victory for those that are his people. When you obey God, he will fight your battles. It's exciting to read of the many victories that God's people won in the Bible. However, sadly, they did not emerge victorious in every battle they fought. Sometimes Israel won, sometimes it was the Philistines. Occasionally, when Israel won the immediate battle, there was sin in the camp that caused more defeats. So with the rest of the message today, I hope to cover seven different battles that are described in the Bible and some of the lessons that we might be able to pick up from those. The first one is the Battle of Jericho, and that's found in Joshua 6. It says, Joshua led the children back to the Jordan River to cross the Promised Land after wandering the wilderness for 40 years. So again, Moses wasn't allowed to cross over. Joshua was the one that was taking the people into the Promised Land. And there were people in the Promised Land already that didn't necessarily want Israel to come. So Israel had to fight their way into the Promised Land and to the land that God had given them. The first obstacle was the city of Jericho. This large walled city was formidable, But through the work of the spies, they learned that the people of Jericho were scared of Israel. Joshua received his marching orders from an appearance of the captain of the Lord's host. This may have been an appearance of God personally to bring the message to Joshua. The message was that the Hebrew military would march around the city once a day for 6 days, and on the seventh day they would march around 7 times. Following God's plan, the children of Israel defeated the city of Jericho. They marched around the city according to their instructions. The walls fell down flat. Israel entered the city, took the city as their first victory in the new territory that God had promised them from 700 years before. The lesson that we can learn from that is to follow God's instructions for victory. Again, most military people, if you tell them the way that you're going to win is just to march around the city once a day for 6 days and march around it 7 times for 7 days, most military people aren't necessarily going to be enthusiastic about that plan. But that was God's instruction, and that's what God used to give them the victory. The second city, called Ai or A-E, is immediately after the Battle of Jericho. Immediately following the Battle of Jericho, the Israelites went up to the city. The whole army did not go because it was a smaller city than Jericho. However, they were turned away by the might of this small town. 36 Hebrews died in the battle that should have been an easy win for them. So here it is, God gave them this great victory. They go to this puny little town and they get their butts kicked, and 36 people were killed. God revealed to Joshua that there was sin in the camp. A man named Achan had taken gold and silver and garments from Jericho. According to God's plan, all the spoils from Jericho were dedicated to God. After that, God planned to allow the children to keep the future spoils. However, when Achan stole what should have been dedicated to God, he brought judgment on the people. After Achan and all he owned was stoned and burned, Israel once again marched against the city of Ai. Against a partial army presented itself to Ai, the men came out against Israel, and Israel fled in retreat. So this was a strategy. So the city won the first time, so they were feeling pretty confident. Israel comes up against the city again, and they start taking off, running away. But this time the retreat was a tactical move to pull the men out of the city so that the rest of the army could enter unabated and take the city. So again, this was a strategy, and it's kind of interesting when you're reading the book of Joshua to see some of the different military strategies that Joshua used. It's in some ways very impressive. So the lesson we learned from this battle is God sees and judges. Don't think that you could deceive God. So Achan was one person. He's thinking, well, I'm just going to sneak some stuff myself, and nobody else is doing it, but I'm going to do that myself. God's not going to notice, or it's not going to affect anything, but it did. God sees everything. God knows everything. And so don't think that you can deceive God. The next battle involves one of the judges of Israel. His name was Gideon. And again, Gideon's an interesting character, because when you think of judges of Israel, you think of mighty men like Samson or these powerful people that had, you were full of courage. Gideon, on the other hand, he was a lot more cautious and careful. God sent an angel to speak to Gideon, who was gathering wheat. Israel had been surrounded by the army of the Midianites and cut off from supplies. Gideon was working diligently, but he got a message from God that God wanted him to lead an army against the enemy. Gideon was humbled by the personal request from God, but agreed to let God use him. So again, in the next paragraph, it says, Gideon gathered all the men he could to go against Midian. His army numbered 32,000 men, but God said that was too many. So there's a picture in the top corner, and that picture is of a fleece. So before we even get to the second paragraph, before Gideon agreed to be the head of God's army, he said, well, I just want to make sure that you're with me, God. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to put this fleece, the blanket, on the ground, and I want it to be wet and the ground around it to be dry when I wake up tomorrow. And so sure enough, he woke up and he was wringing out all this water. And he's thinking, well, maybe that's the way it would do, you know, maybe that's not necessarily a miracle. Maybe that's the way that it would normally be if I left a blanket lying on the ground all night. So tonight I'm going to leave out the same fleece, but I want it to be dry and the ground all around it to be wet. And so sure enough, he did that. The next day there was no water to wring out of the fleece because it was dry. And so he then understood that to be God's miracle to say that, an answer to say that yes, he wanted Gideon to lead the army. So then we'd think that would be enough. Okay, Gideon, go and lead the army. And we'll read what happens. Gideon gathered all the men he could to go against Midian. His army was 32,000 men. But God said, that's too many. When you're the leader of an army, you want to have as many men as you can. You don't necessarily want someone trying to make it a little tougher for you. But God said that was too many. Gideon invited all those that were afraid to go back home without any repercussions. So again, God had to figure out a way to trim down the army. So, okay, any of you 32,000 that are afraid, it's okay, you can go home. And so there's, it says, Gideon was probably disappointed when 22,000 of them turned and walked away. So 22,000 of the 32,000 were saying, yeah, I'm afraid, I don't want to go to battle. And they were allowed to go back. God said that 10,000 were too many. So God instructed Gideon to take the remaining men to get a drink. Most fell on their stomachs to drink deeply from the water. A few reached down and scooped the water to their mouths so they could keep their eyes open for enemies. So the ones that were doing this were keeping their eyes open, and so they were the more alert soldiers. And it says, God told Gideon that these men who were valiant were men that were to go against Midian. While it was good that Gideon was given the best of the soldiers, they only numbered 300 men. If he was disappointed before, he was even more so now. But God assured Gideon the battle would be won by the Eternal and not by the men. God did not want anyone thinking that Gideon and his men won the battle. They were merely tools in God's hand. Standing in the hills over the camp of the 135,000 men, so again, Gideon was able to raise 32,000, and God said, no, that's way too many. 22,000 left, and then eventually he got it down to 300. So we have 300 men going against this army of 135,000 men. However, God told Gideon to go down into the camp and listen to a couple of the men about a dream. So in addition to the fleece, that miracle, God allowed Gideon to sneak into the camp of the enemy at night, and he heard some people talking. It says, one man said that he dreamed that a large loaf of barley rolled down the hill and crushed the encampment. The other man said, there was a vision that Gideon would trample them. They did not know that Gideon and his servant were sitting outside their tent listening to the conversation. Gideon returned to the camp, encouraged for the upcoming battle. So again, God saw that Gideon's faith was a little wavering, and so he caused this miracle to allow Gideon to have confidence that God was going to deliver them. So for the battle, Gideon equipped the men with trumpets, clay pots, and lanterns. At Gideon's signal, they broke the pots, blew their horns. The men of Midian were startled awake with all the noise. So again, they were given a lantern that was covered over by a clay pot, and they had trumpets. They broke the clay pots. The light was then visible. They blew their trumpets. They saw lights. The Midianites came out of their tents. They didn't know what was going on. And it says here, at Gideon's signal, they broke the pots, they blew their horns. The men of Gideon were startled awake with all the noise. Confused, they began fighting one another. Of those who escaped, only 15,000, Gideon was able to capture them in the chase that followed. So again, the 300 chased the 15,000. Of the 135,000, only 15,000 had survived that. So that means there are 120,000 that just killed each other in fear when they saw the lanterns and heard the noise. 15,000 escaped, and the 300 chased after the 15,000 and were able to capture them. There's no question that God gave the 300-man army of Israel victory over the 135,000-man army of Gideon. The lesson we can learn from that one is God is understanding to your unsureness when he asks you to lead 300 versus 135,000. So God understands that you're not going to be, you're not necessarily going to have that confidence, and so he helps you. He helped Gideon. The fourth example of a battle is when the Philistines take the Ark. So again, the Ark of the Covenant was the box that used to hold the Ten Commandments. The people of the children of Israel were given very strict instructions about how it was to be moved around and how it was to be carried. But the Ark was kept in the tabernacle in the area called the Holy of Holies. So it's a very special to God. And Israel tended to look at the Ark as God's presence. And so when we start to read about this here, we'll see how that's significant. It says, Israel battled the Philistines often in the Bible. In 1 Samuel 4, the Philistines overcame Israel and killed about 4,000 men. Israel went to seek the Ark of the Covenant from Shiloh, where it was located, because they were convinced that the presence of the Ark would protect them in battle. They trusted the Ark more than the God of the Ark. So again, Israel was fighting the Philistines. 4,000 Israelites were killed. And their first thought was, we need to get the Ark and bring it to the battle, and that way God will be sure to fight for us. When the Ark arrived in the camp, the Israelites cheered so loudly, the Philistines wondered what was taking place. They had learned the Ark had come into the camp. Though the Philistines had never experienced God's presence directly, they had heard stories, and the stories frightened them. They recounted to one another how God had done mighty works for Israel when he led them out of Egypt. Not wanting to become the servants of Israel, the Philistines fought even harder. They killed 30,000 of Israel's infantry. Besides losing the Ark, the sons of Eli, the high priest, were killed in the battle. And the Philistines put themselves in array against Israel. This is from 1 Samuel 4. So this is the recounting of the events. And it says, and when they joined the battle, Israel was smitten before the Philistines, and they slew many of the field, about 4,000 men. When the people were come to the camp, the elders of Israel said, why has the Lord smitten us today before the Philistines? Let us fetch the Ark of the Covenant out of Shiloh unto us, that when it comes among us, it may save us out of the hand of our enemies. So the people sent to Shiloh that they might bring the Ark of the Covenant, which dwelt between the cherubims, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant. When the Ark of the Covenant of the Eternal came into the camp, they all shouted a great shout, so the earth rang again. When the Philistines heard the noise of the shout, they said, what's the meaning of all this noise and the shout of the camp of the Hebrews? And they understood the Ark of the Lord had come into the camp. The Philistines were afraid, for they said, God has come into the camp. And they said, woe unto us, for there has not been such a thing before. Woe unto us, who shall deliver us out of the hand of these mighty gods? These are the gods that smote the Egyptians and the plagues in the wilderness. Be strong and quit yourselves like men, O Philistines, that you not be the servants of the Hebrews, as they have been to you. Quit yourselves like men and fight. And the Philistines fought, and Israel was smitten, And they fled every man into his tent. And there was a great slaughter, for there fell of Israel 30,000 footmen. And the ark of God was taken, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were slain. So again, the problem here, the lesson that we can learn, is that the ark of God is not a lucky charm forcing God to grant victory against his will. So they had the wrong focus. They needed to focus on God, not on having a lucky charm there to make them win the battles. Three more battles remaining. Battle number five that I wanted to talk about today is Saul against the Amalekites. Samuel had given a battle plan to King Saul for the battle against Amalek. The armies of Israel were to battle the Amalekites and King Agag to the death. There were not to be any animals or men left standing. Saul led an army of 210,000, but Saul and the people did not obey the command of God. They speared King Agag and the rest of the animals, and these animals were supposedly for a sacrifice to God. So here we have Samuel, God's prophet, who gave Saul, the king of Israel, here's instructions on how to do this battle, and instead of following those instructions, Saul allowed the people to not kill all the animals, but instead to take them. And instead of killing the king, as they were instructed, they just took him captive. When Samuel the prophet found out that God's orders were not obeyed, he became angry with Saul. Saul offered his excuses that it was the people who made the decision, that the animals were saved for a good cause. However, Samuel told Saul that God would rather have obedience than sacrifice. So again, God said, kill all the animals. They said, oh, we're going to give them to God as a sacrifice instead. And Samuel makes it very clear. God would rather have obedience than sacrifice. So when people give sacrifices, you know, when sin happens and they give a sacrifice to cover that sin, God isn't necessarily happy with that whole situation. He would rather that you didn't sin in the first place, so there'd be no need for a sacrifice. And so the point that Samuel makes really clearly to Saul is God would rather have obedience than sacrifice. Then there is no need for sacrifice if you're obedient to God. Samuel called for King Agag to be brought before them. The Bible says that he came cautiously before Samuel, still hopeful that his life might be spared. But within moments, Samuel declared that Agag had caused many women to be childless, and his mother was about to lose her child. And at that point, Samuel cut Agag to pieces. So again, Samuel completed the instruction that God had given him. So the lesson we learn from that is described here in the verse, 1 Samuel, verse 15:22, where it says, so Samuel said, has the Lord as great delight in burnt offering and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed is better than the fat of rams. The next battle that we're going to talk about in the Bible is the battle of David and Goliath. Probably the best known battle in the Bible is when the shepherd boy David fought against a well-trained soldier named Goliath. They met when David came to bring supplies to his brothers who were engaged in the battle as soldiers with Israel against the Philistines. Goliath came to the front lines and declared that he would go one-on-one with anyone who dared to face him. Goliath challenged the veracity of the faith of Israel in their God. Goliath did not believe in Israel's God and therefore mocked God because of the fear that the people had for Goliath. David took the challenge and prepared to fight Goliath. King Saul offered his royal armor to David for the battle, and David said he didn't need those things to fight against the giant. He would trust the God of Israel, who had saved him from attacks by a lion and a bear. So when David was young, There were times when he had to protect his flock against a lion, and he was able to defeat the lion. And there was another time where he saved the flock from a bear that was attacking it. So David carefully chose 5 stones from a stream and charged toward Goliath. So again, all it really took was 1 stone to take out Goliath. So David was a little prepared. He took 5 stones with him. But as we see in the picture, Goliath is this giant and David is tiny in his sight. And he has his sling. Goliath was amazed that such a young boy would come so bravely towards him. David fitted a stone in his sling and sent it towards Goliath. God guided the rock, which struck Goliath between the eyes. David took the giant sword of the fallen soldier and cut off his head. The Philistines fled and Israel pursued. God won a great victory in Israel that day through the hand of a young lad who trusted his God. So the lesson that we learned from that battle is described in 1 Samuel 17:26, where it says, "Then David spoke, 'Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?'" Sometimes we can stand up to defend God's honor, and that's what David did. The last battle is one that hasn't occurred yet. It's described in Revelation 19, verses 11 to 21, and that's the Battle of Armageddon, where it says Jesus himself will lead an army at the Battle of Armageddon. Christ and his army will descend on white horses to do battle against the beast, the false prophet, the kings of the earth. Christ and his armies fighting with swords and emerge victorious. The beast and false prophet are taken, cast into the lake of fire. Those who remain are slain. The birds of the field will feast on their flesh. The lesson that we can learn from the final battle, this Battle of Armageddon, is described in Revelation 19:16, where it says, "And he has on his robe and on his thigh a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords." That's the Christ and the God that we worship. For some conclusions, not all battles that Israel and God's people fought ended in victory. It was only when they obeyed the Eternal and trusted in God that they emerged victorious. In our own lives today, we face battles, not on a field with swords and spears, but in our hearts and our minds. Obeying and trusting is still a great strategy. In the book of James, it says, "Where do wars and fights come from among you?" So again, James is going to answer the question, why is there war? I mean, this is one of these questions that has existed through history. Why is there warfare? Why does men kill each other? Why does that happen? And James says, do wars not come from your desires for pleasure that war in your members? So again, warfare comes from the lusts that happen within people. That country, that person, that army, that nation has stuff that I want, and I'm going to take it by force. And so James identifies where wars come from. In Isaiah, chapter 2, verse 4, and it's also repeated in Micah, it says that, again, it's the inscription that's on the picture that's shown there. That's a sculpture that is actually the Soviet Union presented to the United Nations. And again, the inscription is from Isaiah 2:4, where it's talks about God, where it says, "He shall judge between nations and rebuke many people. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore." And again, it's a beautiful sentiment for an institution like the United Nations, which was hopefully to allow nations to talk so that they wouldn't be fighting battles anymore. That's, you know, again, as we spend some time on Remembrance Day thinking about some of the sacrifice that the soldiers have done in Canada on our behalf, and again, thinking about what's happened in countries like in England, where they've had to carry a larger burden than we necessarily have in Canada. We can be, I guess, encouraged by that example that they laid down their life so that we have the freedoms to be able to assemble today and the freedoms to worship as we have come to think of as normal. It's not normal. If you look through history, the ability to worship as we do is not a normal thing. And so we're very privileged to be living when we do now and have the freedoms that we have today. In Ezekiel 37, verse 13, Ezekiel 37, if you recall, is that valley of dry bones. So when people in the Church of God want to talk about the second resurrection, when everyone is going to rise up and have a chance for salvation, Ezekiel 37 is the chapter that we turn to talk about it. And again, it says, "Then you shall know that I am the Eternal." So again, one of the problems we have today, one of the biggest problems we have today, is people don't know God. They don't know which church is teaching about God, so they're often not even looking. They just know there's a lot of confusion out there. This church says this about God, and that church says something else about God, and that religion says something totally different about God. Ezekiel 37, dealing with this time period that's the second resurrection, when the vast majority of people who never knew God are going to rise up and have a chance to know about God, it says, "Then you shall know that I am the Eternal." So when is the world going to know about God? "When I have opened your graves, O my people, and brought you up from your graves." So something about a God being bringing you up from your grave and giving you life again, it's going to make it real in your head that, yes, I believe that is God. I was dead, now I'm alive. That is God. And he says, "Then you will know." So again, now people don't necessarily know about God, or they don't know the true God, and they don't know what his plan is. But at that period of time, they'll know, because God's going to bring them back to life. And to conclude with Ezekiel 37:26, it says, "Moreover, I will make a covenant of peace with them, and it shall be an everlasting covenant with them. I will establish with them and multiply them. I will set my sanctuary in their midst forever." So again, it's talking of a period of time when God's going to be with us. And it's going to be a glorious period of time. But until that time, we remember.